Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Hello, and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand how we think, feel, and relate to our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock, and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross, writer and activist. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest.
Hi, body protesters. We hope you're all well. We have such a fantastic episode for you today. We are speaking with the one and only Jamie Windust. We recorded this back in February, I believe, so before the apocalypse. So bear that in mind. And if you haven't watched their TED Talk already, we recommend you watch that to complement the podcast listening.
So for those of you who know Jamie from social media, you will be familiar with the stunning Jamie face. But we also talk about some of the complications that come with that, having to perform as a non-binary person rather than just existing. We also talk about how can we actually make workplaces safe for trans and non-binary people, as well as the lack of conversation around trans representation and how it can actually be harmful when done wrong. All in all, it's a really beautiful conversation. And of course, we talk a little bit about their new book.
Yeah, and what's exciting about their book is at the time we couldn't reveal the name, but one of the advantages of putting this out so much later than we recorded is that we can disclose the name of the book, which is In Their Shoes. Gorgeous, isn't it? Gorgeous. The book is available to pre-order and it's available to buy on the 21st of October. So make sure you look out for that. The cover is stunning. The book is incredible. So enjoy our conversation with Jamie. Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on The Body Protest.
That's all right. Thanks for having me on this rainy Sunday.
It's a lovely rainy Sunday.
I know you're an award-winning writer, activist, editor,
indeed,
model.
One of those.
What else can we add to the multi-hyphenate?
Yeah, annoying multi-hyphenate. Yeah. So my main kind of fingers and pies would be my day-to-day is I am a writer, public speaker and model. And then I've kind of branched out recently to do a bit more consultancy and kind of curation. So I do quite a lot of curation of events now and kind of making sure that it's kind of like stepping up the kind of public speaking that I do. So instead of just going to events and talking, I like to kind of make sure that what is being said is relevant and there's the right people there. That's my day to day. But I'm a writer. That's what I do most of the time, which is quite fun.
So, I mean, I guess we usually start with a kind of general question, which is, how was your relationship with your body growing up?
It's the language thing. Like, I always define things as weird. I recently started therapy and my therapist started counting the times that I used like weird or strange when I describe either me or things. He told me at the end of the session, he was like, you used the word like 25 times. And I was like, oh.
So do you think you put an otherness on yourself?
Yeah, like I think I always, like my body, I always would describe it as weird because it's like, it's quite ironic because it's like, as a non-binary person, I have quite a feminine body shape. Like I have like quite a waist, and then I kind of go out. So it's kind of, what's that called? Hourglass.
Hourglass.
Kind of.
Snatched.
Snatched, there we go. So, like, growing up, I always kind of felt that I had to fit a body ideal. Mm. And I used to do quite a lot of dance, and we used to have to wear, like, lycra and, like, form-fitting clothing, and everyone else there was, like, ripped and six-packed, and I would never be. And I remember feeling very self-conscious about my body, even though there was nothing to feel self-conscious about, because there never should be. But, like, I think my surroundings made me feel a bit subconscious. But it's interesting because recently I've started going to the gym, which I find really interesting to tell other people, because I told one of my friends that I started going and he was like, oh, I didn't realise you had issues with your body.
It's so interesting that that's how people think about the gym.
And I was like, I didn't have issues. I was like, you can want to change something about your appearance without you having, like, an existential crisis about it.
Also, you can want to go to the gym not to punish yourself. You can just want to go to the gym to move your body around. Like, exercise shouldn't be some kind of... it doesn't have to be some transformative thing.
Yeah, and to be honest, for me, it was more of a mental thing. I was
100%.
It was, like, I was trying to find a new outlet for, like, stress relief or, like, kind of, like, get more into a routine to kind of feel a bit better. Not because I wanted to turn into, like, a bodybuilder or because I had some, like, serious issue with my body. It's outrageous that people go straight to that.
Did you find, when you started using the label of non-binary, did that help with any body image stuff? Like, did you find that you kind of were like, maybe I don't have to conform to such a, like, you know, then, because there isn't a real clear-cut perception of how a non-binary person should exist.
Yeah.
Did you find that helped? Or did it make things more complicated in a different way?
Yeah, I think it definitely does help, because, like you say, there's no one way to look non-binary. I mean, there's no one way to look any gender, but, like, with people who identify as male or female, or who are cis predominantly, like, or trans, but there's a very kind of obvious...
Yeah.
Like, socially conformed and accepted body image that they should look like, whereas with non-binary people, there isn't.
Mm.
However, I think that doesn't still mean that you can't...
Be affected.
To be honest, sometimes... Like, I remember when I started going to the gym and I could see my body changing, I was like, okay, this is really interesting. I was like, do I feel like I look like a ripped... I mean, I'm not ripped, just for the record. But,
I mean, why tell us? Like, extend that disbelief.
I was like, is my body changing to look more like someone who's male that's going to the gym? Or do I look like I have a female? Like, in my head, I was like, what body standard am I holding myself to here?
Right,
It was kind of both. I was like, you know, like, traditional aspects of, like, when female bodies go to the gym, they have, like, a washboard stomach and, like... Yeah. Toned areas.
Yeah, like a bum from doing squats and all that kind of thing. And then if you're a man, you're kind of going to build up muscle. Like,
exactly.
You want that, like, V-shape.
You want that V.
Yeah, the Dorito. I remember thinking that, God, I actually think I'm picking, like, bits of both that I'm seeing change. And I was like...
In a good way or a bad way? Like, did you find that more toxic, being like, I'm now trying to confine myself to, beauty ideals for...
Yeah, like, double the amount of pressure. Yeah, and it was really interesting, because I was like people's reaction, I know it shouldn't count, but it does always count, is people's reaction always found it, they have found it funny that I was going to the gym, which I always thought was a bit rude.
It's really rude.
Like, and I think it's because, like, I present femme, and I think what people were confused about is that if I were to go to the gym, I could potentially come out looking fairly conventionally masculine. And they were like, what? And I was like, well, that doesn't change anything.
No.
Like, if I suddenly got, like, huge arms, I can still do whatever I fancy. I just would have massive arms.
Right, you can still present firm and, have a different shaped body. Right?
Yeah. Like... So, there's a lot of... To be honest, it's very confusing to kind of think of a beauty ideal that... Or a body ideal that I'm non-binary... As me, as a non-binary person, I'm looking at and being like... Uh-huh. What am I? I'm just trying to get a bit healthier and feel a bit, like, mentally and physically a bit better.
I mean, to be honest, I think going to the gym, the only thing I really have ever gained from it is, like, a clear head. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, getting past the fact of, like, going to the gym to try and change something that only gave me body dysmorphia.
Mm.
Whereas going just for myself, you know, it's like meditation. It's like,
oh, yeah.
You know, proper self-care.
I wonder if we can kind of go back a little bit, and you were kind of saying, did you always know that you were non-binary and how that played out for you?
I think I did always know, however, I didn't have the language.
Uh-huh.
So it was kind of like, during kind of puberty and that school time, I always knew that I wasn't cisgendered, but I didn't, like, at the time, like, looking back, I can say that, but at the time, I had no idea.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have the language, but I just knew that I was kind of not anywhere. I was just kind of, like, floating in the middle.
Yeah.
But I didn't know where that was at that point. And I think having then kind of gone on to learn the language and the education and kind of actually finding more about it, that was when I moved to university. I was like, oh god, there's so many bits and bobs here that are actually really present themselves to me as something that I fit into.
Yeah. They're just, I feel like growing up, the narratives you heard around transness were very similar, and it was usually kind of very much, I don't know, I think it was just a very narrow perception. It was a Channel 4 documentary. It was never something that was a widely accepted thing. And were there any things where you saw that growing up and you went, oh, maybe that's me. Maybe that's my situation.
Yeah, there was definitely times, like, it was very, like, casual and almost, like, jovial instances where, like, on the telly there'd be someone who, again, because the, like, the language wasn't there, but they would be, like, male presenting, but would be, like, very femme.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it would almost be, like, I think when I was growing up, those types of people that were on telly or in the media were kind of just seen as very camp, flamboyant.
Yes.
Gay men. But I always resonated with that. I think growing up, I just always resonated and just presumed that I was just this, like, very camp, flamboyant gay man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember always thinking, like, looking at, like, red carpet events or the Oscars and thinking, like, why could I not wear, like, a ball gown?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then actually, like, because I did, at the time, I didn't have the awareness or the knowledge. I was just kind of at a point where I was like, oh, I guess I can't. When actually that's, like, not the case at all. I just didn't really know. I didn't know the history of it. You know, like we said, non-binary identities have existed for centuries, but the conversation around transness, especially in, like, the Western media, is so, like, binary that, like, we just weren't given that opportunity, I think, to be seen. And there's a lot of factors that come into that, you know, but...
Well, also, we're just not taught any queer history at school, really.
No, not
you know... There's a huge chunk of history around trans people that has been destroyed. And we have so, you know, like you said, it's existed for centuries and people just don't have the information and the conversation's only just really beginning. How old were you when you started to experiment with makeup?
I remember I was like 16 because I was going to prom and my mum was like, why are you wearing talc on your face? And I was like, oh, it's makeup. So I was like 16 and then I started working, in a department store, on the menswear section and then realized that there was the beauty hall, which was like my mecca at that point. It's iconic. And then, moved over there at like 17. So I was still at sick form and just kind of like a part-time job. And that's when I really started to get into it. And then when I moved to university at 18, I was exploring it a lot more and having fun with it. And then that's kind of when the Jamie face came around.
Yeah.
Which people, what makes me laugh about that is people get so philosophical about it and they get so like, they just want to know why and they have so many questions and I'm like, I always just say, and it winds them up, and I like it. And I'm just, they're like, why? And I'm like, because I can.
Yeah.
Because there's literally no one telling me, I mean, there are a lot of people telling me I can't, but realistically, there's no one, like, forcing my hand away from putting all of that makeup on my face.
No. It's, like, very joyful expression. I mean, I remember once before we, before I ever met you, I mean, I only met you today properly, but I've been aware of you for a long time. I once saw you walking in Soho with the classic Jamie face on, and I was like, oh, it's really cheered me up. Like, you just looked radiant and so yourself. And I was like, that's really special. Like, that's really... There's something about someone who celebrates makeup in the way that you do, which I think is so rare and so special, because it is truly what makeup is about, is just the core of expression and being playful, and your face is this blank canvas, and it's like, well, why wouldn't I?
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why I loved it so much, and I still love it. It's my relationship with it has changed quite a lot in the past, like, 6 months, purely because it's like... I still appreciate that joy of it, but what I found was that, like, the public perception to that and the way that that was impacting just, like, on my literal day-to-day life was getting way too much. So I've stripped it back kind of in a protective way for myself. It's a bit sad because no one should ever be fearful to play with makeup and have that, you know, like, the joy that we said about, but... Sometimes you've just got to do what you think is right for you in that moment.
Well, also, I think you, in a way, have become such a figurehead for this movement, and I feel like you shouldn't have to put yourself in danger just to make other people feel good.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, taking a step back and pulling the makeup back, that was for your safety and your happiness, and, like, you don't owe that to anyone else.
Yeah, and it took me quite a while. Like, this is very recent, but it took me quite a while to realise that. Because I did a shoot a couple of weeks ago, and I went in... like, non-Jamie makeup, but just kind of, like...
A subtle beat.
Yeah, so, yeah, like a casual beat. And they were literally like... I got there and they were like, oh.
Were they expecting the full Jamie?
Yeah, they were expecting the full shebang. And they were just, like, obviously disappointed. And I was like, well, it is really weird. Like, I'm not going to name names, but I've got a couple of shoots coming that, like, they've specifically asked for the Jamie beat. And because I am my own best devil's advocate, I'm always, like, overanalyzing everything. So I'm just like, isn't that funny that they've, like, specifically requested the Jamie beat? I'm like,
how does that make you feel?
A bit weird.
Like, does it make you feel like a commodity?
More and more recently, a lot of the kind of shoots that I do are more tied into the work that I do.
Yeah.
So they're kind of campaign-led with a message. However... So, like, when I'm asked to be Jamie for that, I find that a bit odd. But then on the flip side, if it's, like, a fashion thing or an editorial thing, or, like, if it's makeup-focused and they've asked me to come with the Jamie face, I quite like that.
Yeah.
Because it's, like, that's the point of the shoot. It's, like, expressive, it's editorial, it's, like, wild, and that's fine. But when you get, like, people that want it... Like, I just know when people want it because they know it's going to... be clickbait, essentially.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's really bizarre, but
yeah. But I think the point about your safety, and I know you spoke about it on the TED Talk, and you've written about it, and kind of like what it meant and why you stopped doing the Jamie face in public and whatever. Yeah. I think is really important, because I think it. I don't know. We can look at it on social media or whatever, and like. And appreciate the expression and the artistry and the joy of it to look at, but and then you lose sight of how that might play out in someone's real life and what. And I think that's part of being in a liberal bubble and like understanding that. So I think just the appreciation of you writing and sharing and talking about actually, you know, this has consequences or can, because we still live in a world where some people. Awful.
Yeah, and what I find really interesting is like I still get now quite a lot of criticism. About a year ago, I did a crowdfunder for like taxi transport, like private transport, because I just like physically couldn't get public transport for kind of like my mental health was really low, and I was just like it was just constantly like a barrage of. Invasion, essentially, because like literally every single tube journey I'd have the person opposite me trying to like take a picture or just like yapping at me about like why have you know. And what I found really interesting is that even from within my own community and from outside, I had a lot of criticism for asking for essentially allyship for the private transport, because people saw the makeup as something that is removable.
Right.
So they were like, if it's causing you this much grief, just don't put it on. And what I found interesting there is, like we said, it's a tool for joy, but it's also intrinsically tied into my gender expression.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So to just kind of be like, don't do that, for me, it was really difficult. I've learned to do it now because my safety is more important. However, yeah, it's still, like, I still feel, I'm always grieving for that. Yeah. I do feel very sad that I just don't feel able to do that at the moment.
Do you think, yeah, I was going to say, do you think that this is a permanent change, or do you think the Jamie face will come back?
I think it's really
it's so hard to know.
Yeah, and it's like, it's common, it's almost like morphed now because it's taken a new life. So like, I've got stuff coming up in this month that I know that is important, and people like have asked me to come as like,
yeah,
the Jamie, mm-hmm, which is really weird. So I will like bring, again, weird to say, but I'll bring the face out.
Mm-hmm.
And so the relationship with it has almost moved into like a performance.
I was going to say it does sound like, and what I find frustrating about the situation on your behalf is it seems like people are very happy to make you, you know, turn up, perform, be this kind of like queer icon, and then the minute you're actually asking for allyship and help, they're like, well, hang on,
yeah,
like, you know, we only like you when you're happy and performing and, you know, being our little dancing monkey. And
yeah,
then they're like, that is such a problem we have nowadays with so many kind of Instagram influencers, in the sense that like people forget that there's a real person on the other end of that.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, you enjoy, yeah, us, you consume us, you know, you take and you take and you take, and then when we ask for something back, you don't give.
Yeah, like even very small things, like when I've done shoots before, I've done events where it's very late night finishes, and I'll just be like, can I get private transport home?
Yeah.
And I'll just be like, no, sorry, we don't have the money for it. And I'm just kind of like left there like, we just had like a really amazing inclusive chat, and now you're
yeah,
like the irony of me literally going on and doing kind of discussions where I talk about like street harassment, and then once the doors close at midnight, they're like, right, see ya,
yeah,
like,
good luck, yeah,
yeah,
on you go.
Yeah, because it's, I mean, I think people are so unwilling to accept the true prejudice towards queer people and towards non-binary people, and just, I mean,
and I think we've got to a point where it's like, it's an appealing aesthetic, it's something that,
yeah,
like, we want represented because it's new, it's quirky, it's edgy, it's cool. It's, I feel it's very on trend in many ways. But yeah, it's that kind of follow through to like, actually, what's the reality? Just as you're saying, like, oh yeah, we have this inclusive chat, but then we close the door at midnight, and then it's like, on you go, good luck. Yeah,
yeah.
I think that
it's like it, and as well, what I find really interesting is the way that non-binary identities are being consumed. Is it still very much femme, for like non-binary femme people?
Yeah. Yeah.
Are being consumed because the media, it's kind of like misogyny, like they love femininity, like femininity is something that a lot of people like to consume because they like to look at it, and it's visually, can be visually appealing, whereas, you know, non-binary people who are AFAB, so like assigned female at birth, a lot of non-binary people like that are not showcased in the same way or platformed in the same way, or people who are non-binary but present masculine, they're not given that same platform because for some reason it's not appealing. And what I struggle with at the moment is this kind of sellable, marketable nature of transness.
Yeah,
that it's becoming too vapid. People are just only caring because, you know, like we said, I'm going to turn up with the Jamie face, and they're going to get exposure, or they're going to get clicks from it. And I'm getting frustrated with it.
Because in some ways you want the representation, because I think like there's something about being seen. I think that's not just about queer and trans identity. It's about, like, you know, seeing people of colour, it's seeing people of different sizes. You want the representation because you want to feel seen and understood in the world. But then it's that fine line of, like, if it's just done as a commodity, if it's just co-opted, if it's just done as, and then it's like, how do you follow through? And and you mentioned at the beginning that you do like consultancy. Is that with brands on?
Yeah, because like
on that follow through.
Like, don't get me wrong, I think representation is really important, and the work that I do, like the, when I say social work, I don't mean like traditional like social social work. I mean like Instagrammy work.
Yeah.
I've realised that it's I remember when I started doing it, I was really torn about it, and I just didn't really know what to do. I've now realised it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're not working with, like, the army or someone annoying, it's fine. And almost more for my sake, but also for the people that work with me's sake, I wanted to elevate the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because I was getting job satisfaction out of it, but I was also like, this brand activism thing isn't as revolutionary as people think it is. It's not changing the world. And what it does is it pedestals that type of activism as the only and most important type, when actually that's not the case at all. So what I did kind of for job satisfaction and to feel like I was actually doing something was I started to offer consultancy behind the scenes with the brands that I work with to actually make their internal systems change, them change as people outside of work. And I won't say name names, but it's very interesting as to who says yes to that and who says no.
Right.
I get a lot of people being like, we don't want that. We don't need that.
On the surface, like, look, we're so woke, we're so great, we're doing all of this amazing activism. And then when you're like, yeah, but can we change the infrastructure? They're like, whoa, absolutely not.
And then especially, it's very interesting. They get even more stressed when you then asked to be paid to do that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god, yeah.
And they're like, what are you on about?
What changes have you found people are more receptive to in terms of your consultancy? Like, what are things that you would pitch to try and make a brand more inclusive?
One of the big things that I try and do to kind of start off with is to look at workplace environments.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of trans people are in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of harassment that they face often with people who work in traditional work environments is in the workplace. So I try and start off with kind of making sure that your workplace is trans inclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Even if there are no out trans people working there, it means that if trans people did want to work there, that they know it's a safe environment.
Yeah.
And then I kind of branch it out into looking at language. I think language is really important, and it's something that's not hard to change, and I really like kind of analyzing the ways that brands use language, because often it's not done out of prejudice, but it's done out of business sense. They want to kind of split their off, like, for example, in fashion, I've been, during my degree I did fashion business, and we spent so long kind of looking at the ways in which why products are actually split into gender, because it makes more money. However, taking that away is actually going to bring such a bigger base of people to your brand in like quite a crude sense. That's quite businessy, but like, it just makes everything more freeing.
Well, the thing is, if you're trying to appeal to a business, of course you're going to have to look at it through a business lens. So I think it's more than fair to say you would be opening up a market that has been previously untapped if you make things trans inclusive, non-binary inclusive.
So
would it be about getting rid of the like any binary labels, or like the women's section and the men's section? Is that kind of what?
Yeah, because there's for example, there's an amazing store in New York called the Fluid Project, which is just a shop with clothes in, and you just
turn up.
The sizes are, they don't use like small, medium, large. They use, I don't remember what they use. I think it might be numbers still, but it's in a way to promote that the clothes are literally for anyone if you want to wear them. Then again, because I'm so annoyingly self-analytical, I do get quite frustrated that a lot of the conversations I'm having about identity and transness are for businesses, which are essentially to make them money. Which is why now I'm trying to kind of move away from, not move away, but really just focus on uplifting kind of the grassroots people that are trying to do the work on the ground that's actually going to save lives, rather than helping a global business make more money.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, although I think there is a bit of a bind there, because I think they have so much power, and I think in terms of like being able to change of conversation. I think businesses can change conversation because they are a global entity, so they can, if they decide they want to, I think they can influence some change. I don't think all change, but I think they do have the capacity to make waves more than governments do sometimes. Because I think if they decide it's in their interest to do it, they can. But you have to then navigate and negotiate with yourself that, are you happy for them to make money as a consequence of that?
Yeah.
And I think, well, I'd rather them do it. And if they're making money from it, then good, because then there's a chance that they're going to continue to do that and do something that I want them to do.
Also, I guess in the way of, and I often feel this, and I wonder if you do, but in the sense of, I always think, well, if I had seen someone like me doing the things that I'm doing now as a child or a teenager, it would have changed everything. And I think, do you feel that kind of pressure to be working with brands and be this public face? Because you're like, well, if someone who is in the same position you were then, you know, if they saw you, that might change their life.
Yeah, that's exactly. Because like I said, when I was younger, there was no one.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the benefits, actually, of working with these people. Like you say, they have such a platform that often it does, even if it's just visual representation, that can sometimes be enough for people to feel more comfortable in themselves and feel like they actually can be themselves in the long term. Yeah, definitely. I think that's what I think. That's one of the biggest things I forget, actually, with the work that I do, is that representation is important. It's not everything. Yeah. And representation, I always say, is like step one.
Yeah,
a lot of people stop after they get representation. And often what I found, especially with like the TED Talk, is they were brilliant at realizing that visual representation is actually dangerous for trans people or minorities. So they put in a lot of work to make sure that, yes, I was visually represented and the community was. However, there are also lots of negatives that come with that, like being on such a high platform as someone that can easily be targeted. And a lot of people don't realise that when it comes to visual representation, which is kind of why I have a tricky relationship with that.
Is that like trolling, like people like sending like nasty messages and stuff? And
it's because like the anti-trans climate in the UK is so malicious.
Yeah.
That, you know, these people will really find out where your next event is. They'll track you down. You know, it's very intense. So a lot of the time people don't understand that, you know, by plastering a trans person on a campaign,
you're putting them in danger.
Yeah, definitely. So, yeah.
Is that a conversation you wish people were having more?
Yeah. I think definitely. I think, you know, people who are trans or marginalised groups, we're outspoken because we've always had to be.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening is some people are listening now. Some people are actually being like, okay, we can't just use these people for our gain. Like, these people are actually human beings who are going to potentially suffer from what we're doing.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you're going to work with someone and they don't understand that, then you just step away. You shouldn't be able to step away.
Yeah.
So what did TED do that particularly well about navigating that and negotiating that with you?
I think it was just the amount of contact time that we had. Like, it was like a 3-4 month process of curation and bonding, essentially, and leading up to the release of the video. We just had loads of conversations about, you know, they were so open and honest and kind of aware that I knew more than they did on what could happen. So they just sat back and were like, right, what do we need to be potentially prepared for? What could happen? And, you know, they just made sure that whatever I said could happen and what could that they could do to help that, they did.
Right.
Which, to be honest, was quite rare. I was quite surprised that they were just, like, willing to be like, what do you want? And I was like, oh, brilliant.
It's like, wow, I didn't know it could be this easy.
Yeah. And, for example, we worked with media partners on TED.
Yeah.
And they were really supportive in saying what I needed without me having to say it to them, because sometimes I can feel a bit, I don't know, not stressed, but like on edge, kind of having to explain myself all the time. Yeah. So they were very much like, they knew the emotional labour of what that could entail. So they did it. So it's just, they're just a very switched on
That's wonderful, really lovely to hear.
Yeah, it's so rare. And I think that's where it's like, where you're saying like representation first, then you there's all of these other pieces to fit, to make it actually genuinely inclusive. Well, we've touched on language quite a bit, but I wonder if we can get more into the nuances of it. And so we've got like gender identity and gender expression, and so you identify as non-binary, but you express as femme, right? Like, is that...
Yes, there's a massive difference of like gender identity and gender expression. I think that's one massive thing that a lot of people either aren't aware of or don't understand the difference. Because, like, for example, it's not just for non-binary people. Like, everybody has a gender expression.
Yeah.
Mm. Take, for example, like, some gay cis men, their gender identity is cis.
Yeah.
Male, but they can often have a gender expression that is very femme.
Yeah.
It doesn't negate their identity, it just means that that's how they're choosing to express it. For example, when non-binary people choose to present their gender expression in a very, air quotes, binary way, it doesn't mean they're not non-binary, it just means that's how they're presenting. And that, I think that's something that's really important when you have non-binary people who their gender expression is quite conventionally binary, like predominantly with non-binary people that present masculine. I know quite a lot of people who, they wouldn't mind me saying that, like, if you were to walk past them on the street, you would just think it's a cis man.
Yeah.
But they're non-binary. And those are the groups of people that I think actually struggle the most.
Right.
Often is this, like we said earlier, this whole non-binary thing often kind of gets packaged up into a look.
Yeah.
And it's like white, like androgynous, femme, quite like wild, whereas actually there's so many ways to look non-binary that it can almost manipulate and alienate the conversation around it, which is really frustrating.
It's interesting because the way we started was kind of going, you know, do you think there's a certain pressure to look a certain way as a non-binary person? And actually, I guess there kind of is, which is, you know, you have to do this kind of outlandish fashion and all of these things. And it's like, actually, you know, it's so fluid, and it's just, like you said, it's how you're presenting that day. It's so varied. Yeah, it's very interesting, especially because you have carved out so many different looks for yourself and so many different places to be. And I don't know, it seems strange that we have such a narrow perception of it.
Yeah, and I kind of have to, I have to really think about that a lot of the time. Is, I know it's not on me, and it's not my fault that often people will hire me as a non-binary person, and I could be the only non-binary person. So therefore, by elimination, I am often sometimes seen as the way, or the way that is non-binary people are palatable commercially. However, I think what's important is that I use my voice to ensure that these conversations that we're having now, and like the kind of conversation around non-binary visual expression, is shared, so that there is no one way to look at, which is why, you know, me coming here today and just like a casual beat compared to the Jamie face doesn't actually change my identity in any way.
Of course.
Which some people don't know how to wrap their head around.
That's really interesting.
I feel like you spend a lot of time dealing with people's bullshit, which is exhausting and draining, and I just have nothing but empathy for you in that situation. What are things that you do to protect your energy, to look after yourself? What is your self-care? Like, and real self-care, not even just like a face mask, like, you know, the boring shit.
My biggest one is just saying no.
Yeah.
Like, it's saying no and not apologising. I used to be a massive people pleaser.
How did you learn not to be?
From like, just like last year is my first year of working for myself. Like, this is, I'm now in my second year. And what I realised last year was I just had so many burnouts.
Yeah.
I had so many just like crashes that I just didn't know how to deal with. But I thought at the time that that's just what everyone had. And I was like, this is mostly what it's like to be busy and working. Fine.
Yeah.
And then I realised, actually, no, you can say no to going to that shit party down the road.
It takes those burnouts to learn boundaries. Like, you need to have those horrible experiences where you're like, oh my God, why am I, like, dead inside? And you're like, oh, because I've gone to one too many corporate events and I need to stop.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, like, also realising, like, in the least savage way, like, who I need in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what I found was when I started implementing these boundaries to myself, I suddenly got this reputation for being rude or a bitch or boring. So what I then actually quite nicely found is it almost filtered the people that don't actually care about my well-being, in a way.
Yeah. You know, I'd rather be called a bitch and be well-rested than, like, correct. You know, I don't, like... Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues we have as a society is the fact that everybody feels the need to be liked by everyone. It's like, you know what? It really doesn't matter. It's like, you need to look out for yourself, number one. Like, you need to...
Especially, like, the stuff that we all do. Like, it's so intense.
Yeah.
You know, we need to have that downtime. You know, what I find really interesting is, like, if I do, like, panels or something, like, I remember I did a panel last year where it was literally, like, so emotionally intense. And then straight after people, I was like... They just don't understand boundaries. They're just, like, continuing to have the conversation.
Yeah,
like,
face, yeah.
Like, taking photos or just, like, it's invading your space. And it's, like, I've just sat on stage, probably not being paid, to talk about, like, my trauma.
Mm.
To open up your minds, in a way. And even after TED. So, after TED, there was an interval. And we got taken into the lobby for, like, a meet and greet.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you know, TED was so emotional, and I just had people come up to me saying, I loved your talk, I loved your outfit, but, like, I don't really understand.
Oh, my God.
And it's not the time, and I think I'm getting, like, worked up, because I think it's, like, people want you to do that diversity inclusion, be angry, activate on something, or, like, advocate for something, and be forceful and share all of this stuff, but then actually, and then to then come back and be like, oh, too angry, uncomfortable. Like, that is, like, that I find that
the
really
commodification of vulnerability is fully what it is. It's like, you know, we want you to be vulnerable, but then, like, oh, but not too real. Like, like, you know, like, the minute it's actually like, hang on, can you leave me alone? Can you give me some space? They're like, whoa, that's a little bit too honest.
Yeah,
it's like,
it's vulnerability, and it's also being like, oh, yeah, tell us what we're doing wrong, tell us how we can be better, how we, you know, give us all the instructions, but do it in such a palatable way, do it in such a, like, way that then it's like, okay for us, and then we're going to pick and choose what we're going to take anyway. So
do
then we
the
can...
emotional labor to skirt around our egos, but, you know, it's just
it's like, I did I wrote something recently about, like, cis fragility, because after TED what I realized is people's reaction to what I said isn't on me, it's because they are being challenged.
Yeah,
it's like with white people with race, like, it's that go-to to be defensive.
Yeah,
we're like, well, I'm not a bad person. It's like, well, Maybe not knowingly, but, like, everyone has things that they need to learn or unlearn.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make you an awful person.
Well, it's like when people think the word privilege is an insult. And it's like, no, everyone has privilege. It's just about assessing your level of privilege and admitting it and, you know, staying vigilant.
It's like, I've had this really bizarre person on my Instagram all week just, like, commenting on everything saying, I'm cis, so you don't care about me. I'm cis, so I don't matter. I'm like...
Get out of the violin.
It's just like all cis people, like, cis people have made it so they're the only thing that mattered for hundreds and hundreds of years. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, come on. Like, we've had our time. Like,
but and you get that on, like, every intersect, right? So you get that on the white people calling people white people. It becomes
that. Dare you call me a white person? It's like, but you are.
I just have no idea how to deal with that. It's just completely baffling.
But it's like, it's like not even your job to, but then what makes it so frustrating, it's put on you to solve or reconcile that, or go home and then be like, oh, I've just had all of this, like, put on me, and now what do I do with it? And I think people don't necessarily understand the implications that has. So kind of like coming off the TED Talk, which even if you're talking about, I don't know, tea for something very neutral, doing something as big as that, it's going to be like, you'll have all the adrenaline, you'll be like pumped up.
I was actually like a bit crushed because it's like I said, it's like a 3-4 month like process. I've never, had to learn something like that off script before. Like, you know, it's you have so it's many huge. Rehearsals. Like,
it's huge.
You kind of go through it with, like, this family of people, like, all the other speakers, you get so close to them all.
Yeah.
And to do something like that, and then literally half an hour later, to be challenged on what you're said, because people can't wrap their head around how other people might need help, was baffling to me. I was actually really upset.
Yeah,
I was
like, no, like understandably.
Yeah, because it's like they just had no consideration for the amount of work that has got into it. They just thought you rocked up.
Exactly.
It's so insulting. Yeah,
and it's like the actual work that even if you're talking about teed to like build up to like prepare that, and then it's like, then because it is identity, it is personal, that it's the emotional work as well.
I just got to a point where, so like the first person that asked me, I was just like quite nice.
Yeah.
And then, like, by the last person, I just ended up literally saying, I shouldn't have to tell you how to be a good person.
Yeah, read a book.
Left. Yeah.
Good for you.
Because I'm just like, don't ruin this day.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, it's not your job to convince people to be empathetic.
No.
That's their own problem. Like, you know, it's really sad that as a society, we basically have forgotten what empathy is and have no understanding, and also think it's other people's jobs to educate us on things we don't understand. It's like, no, it's your own job to educate yourself.
Though on books, rumour has it there might be a book on the way.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Can we talk about that?
I'm actually, after this, I have to go and I've just got it back from the copy editor.
Oh, I didn't realise it was that far along.
So exciting. It's
like a baby.
It's like all the tiny little... So I've done like all the big edits, but it's like all the tiny little like grammar edits, which is really actually quite boring.
What's the title? Can we know? Or is it top secret?
I think it's a secret.
It's a secret. Okay.
Can we have the premise of the book?
Yeah. So it's... I'm one of those really annoying 22-year-olds who's doing a part memoir.
I was about to say, that's iconic.
So it's kind of part memoir. No, it's not. They were very adamant on not using the word memoir, but it kind of is.
Right.
So it's kind of how to navigate being trans or non-binary now, but for kind of like quite a millennial audience, because a lot of conversation at the moment is either for like very young people, which is absolutely fine, or it's quite academic.
Yeah.
Right.
And what I've tried to do is make it funny, but also very real. Because I'm quite dry, I'll say. Like, I've got some outrageous stories, and it's kind of for everyone. Obviously, it's got non-binary and trans-specific information, but I think a lot of that information is universal.
And also, it's an amazing thing to just, like, send someone the Amazon link and be like, if they're being, like, bothering you can be like, here, read my book.
Actually read
buy my book.
Literally read a book.
Give me commission. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. 100%.
TED Talk, then book. When's the book out?
So the book is out in October.
Oh, heaven.
They are designing the cover as we speak.
I guess on that lovely positive note, we should probably... wrap up. I could talk to you all day. Jamie, where can we find you?
So I am
on the internet, not
on the internet, not.
Yeah. We don't want to send people your way.
So both Instagram and Twitter is Jamie_Windust.
And your book will be out in October.
October, there we go.
And we can link to the TED Talk.
And we will link to the TED Talk.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.
That's all right. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Body Protest podcast.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode. It would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is edited by the angels at Project Harness, Daisy and Rasheen.
And brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.